Y'all gonna see this lit off.
That's me, yeah.
Okay.
Mine's all words.
Okay.
Yeah, me too.
I'm going to distract you from watching the screen while that's getting organised, and we'll start because we've just stuffed everything around by just changing the order. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. I'm Senator Rachel Seward. I think I was picked on to facilitate this discussion because I take a very strong interest in social policy. I'd like to thank you all for coming for this discussion on the recession and social policy, what happens after the GFC and social policy, and it's an issue that's very dear to my heart, so I was very pleased to be asked to chair and facilitate this discussion. And as I've just said, we've just turned the order on its head and we've decided that Professor Bob Gregory should be our first speaker. Professor Gregory is a graduate of the University of Melbourne and the London School of Economics and Political Science. He's currently Professor of Economics at the Research School of Social Sciences in the Australian National University right here in Canberra. Professor Gregory has been closely involved in Australian economic policy development. He was a member of the Board of Management at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. And that's me that I have to go off and vote. I was hoping we'd go for 5 more minutes and we wouldn't have to. So I apologise. I'm going to have to get between here and the Senator, the Senate. I'll be back as soon as we've voted. So, Bob, please start. As you can tell, he's got heaps of credentials to talk about this issue. And let's get it underway. And then you can hopefully listen to Bob and I'll get back and hopefully hear most of it as well.
Thank you.
I'll be back as soon as I can. Sorry.
You can hear it this volume, I take it. Is that right?
Yeah.
And who's... Am I doing this? Are you going to do this? Okay.
I don't mind. I'll have to do
it
if you'd like.
Okay. I'll just go like that.
Yep.
She's there. Press. If I go like that, you say, ooh. If I go like that, you clap, right? this has been an extraordinary period of time from, say, November last year to today. Right in November, the world collapsed, essentially, and it has for the UK and for the United States and so on. It was widely predicted at that time that the world would not collapse here. I interpreted that myself to be sort of naive optimism on the basis of the Treasury and the bank, but in fact that's the way it sort of turned out. So at this point, the recession is extremely mild, and at this point I think the time may well have come to start worrying about the next recession rather than the current one, because if we don't have a very deep one this time, there will be another recession quite soon, and I might sort of, by soon I mean 4 or 5 years down the track, because one of the things that happens when you have a deep recession is you sort of sort out people's expectations about the future. There's a lot of shocks going on, and so people are more conservative about inflation, more conservative about wage increases, more conservative about house prices and share markets. And to a large extent, most of those things, with the exception of the share market, has escaped. I mean, we are one of the very few countries, for example, where house prices more or less... If you want to argue, you can argue house prices have gone up through the recession. They would not have gone up by very much, but you know, you can get some data together to say they've gone up by 1 or 2%, say, and that's just quite unusual. So, but having said that, the first picture I want to show you is this one, and this one is persons employed, and it's the recession of the 80s, the 90s, and today. And what I've done is taken the level of employment at the beginning of each one of the recessions and then just counted out the quarters. So 10 is 10 quarters after the recession started. And then from the beginning levels, I've just taken the changes. So everything starts at zero, and if employment falls, you're below the line, and if employment rises, you're above the line. And I've divided into full and part-time. It happens that in Australia, full-time has grown throughout the recession. Part-time has grown throughout the recession. So part-time's above the horizontal line, full-time is below. The black is today's recession, and you can see we're about five quarters in. The red is the 91 recession, and the blue is the 81 recession. So there's clearly a recession in the sense that you can see by looking at the black line that the employment level has fallen. That is, from the beginning it's fallen, and it's still more or less falling. But I think the major point I want to make about this picture is that if you get to the fifth quarter, which is about now, the recessions are different, but they're not that different. That is, that in all of them, employment is sort of falling, right? And now the current recession, you can see it's sort of breaking away. But the point I want to emphasize is that in these two recessions of 80 and 91, the big differences occurred after you were well into the recession. So if you looked at the 91 and the 81 recession, at the fifth quarter, they look the same. They've both lost the same amount of employment. But then after the fifth quarter, the blue line, which is the 80 recession, clearly is into recovery mode. And the 91 recession is clearly not. So the employment at the 10th quarter in the 91 recession is still down dramatically. So what that says is that even though we have a lot of optimism at this point, it's nowhere near clear that it's necessarily over. That is, the difficulty of predicting what's happening from this point onwards is just as difficult as it was predicting at the beginning. So, and you can see this in part with, you can almost see it happening sort of monthly and with a bit of tension between the bank and the Treasury, you know, when they're trying to look ahead. And it's quite clear that, you know, maybe, I think it's quite clear maybe 3 months ago, so one of these quarters ago, the Treasury was still worried about a red line type scenario going forward. The bank was a bit more optimistic with the blue line going forward, as it were. And now I think, you know, more and more people are moving in the blue line type direction. So that the current recession is now thought of as sort of turning around fairly quickly. But whether that will happen or not, I don't know. So instead of having the worst recession since the interwar period, World War I to World War II, it now looks as though we may have one of the milder recessions. And that's not many countries around the world, at least in the old OECD Western world, can say that. I mean, the Chinese can say that, and the Indians can say that. We can say it maybe, and perhaps even the Canadians might be able to say it. But the US can't, the UK can't, Germany can't, Japan can't. So we're quite different. And the reason for that is, I'm not going to go into the reason, but they're all the sort of things, everything you read in the newspapers is roughly right. You know, the reasons for that is a mineral boom, the banks were in pretty good shape when we went in, the economy was growing quickly before we went in. Our government has been the leader in the OECD countries in terms of moving in fast. And that was a product partly of a new government. I think an old government would have been slower, partly of a product of a new government, and partly the product of a government which was in good financial system. In a good financial situation before the recession, that is, they could afford to go on. So if there's a big deterioration from now on, which I'm not expecting, but if there was, the government would not feel that, I don't think that it could put in an extra big expansion like it did at the beginning. So the next one. So this just re-emphasises the point that I wanted to make about how some of these recessions can go on and drag on and get out of hand. So the 81 recession is the black line and the 90 recession is the dotted line. Now I've got months since the recession started, and now I've broken it up into men and women. So this is the women's picture, and you can see that within within about 2 years after the 81 recession, women's full-time employment was back to where it was at the start, and then it just grew, right? Whereas in the 90 recession, at the 55 point, 55 quarters later, which is what, 5 years later, it's only just clawing its way back. So I guess the important point to emphasise here is the one that I've already done, which is the recessions are of different length. But I think the other important point to realise is that reporting about recessions in newspapers and things vary a lot depending on what you focus on. So, you know, if you focus on GDP growth or stock market growth, recessions are much shorter in those terms, right? You can already see them. The stock market has bounced back, what, 40% or something. Recessions in employment terms are much longer. So, you know, you'll get large numbers of people saying the recession is over. So in the 90 recession, lots of people saying, oh, the recession's over by here. But for women, it's still a disaster area because it's over in share market terms, it's over in house price terms, it's over in GDP growth terms. And I think that's important for the topic we're discussing today. The next one. Now, this is the men's, and you can see that the same picture about the 91 being more deep, but you can see how much deep, right? So back here, after the first year, which is roughly where we are now for the current recession, they're not that different, which I said before. Then they diverge, and you can see that the bottom was reached about 2.5 years in. So that's about 18 months away. And then you can see by the end of this graph, which is sort of 5 years, that male full-time employment is still not recovered. And that's what I want to talk about now for quite a while, is that this male full-time employment story in our recessions has been a very, very serious story. Part-time employment, by and large, just churns on through the recessions. If you looked at part-time employment numbers, you wouldn't even be able to pick a recession. The recessions are all concentrated basically on the full-time market, primarily concentrated on men, and primarily lasting much, much longer than all other indicators of recessions. So the next one. Now, I want to talk about the disappointment of the long boom. Before this recession, Australia went through a very long boom, which was sort of comparable to the 50s and 60s. And this long boom delivered lots of income and wealth to large numbers of Australians, most of whom I guess are in this room. So, of those who picked up lots of gains, almost everybody in this room would be in that set, right? For those who've got super, you did very well. For those in full-time employment, you did very well. For those who own houses, you did very well. So it's a very, very strong boom. And it was a boom in which the future of Australia, people's perception of the future changed as well. Everybody became extremely optimistic. So I want to focus on the disappointments of the boom. And the disappointments of the boom relate, as I said at the very beginning, that different characteristics, you know, depending on which characteristics you focus on, you're going to get different stories. And the full-time employment story is the most depressing part the boom in Australian history. And I want to talk, and that's really important for welfare policy, because welfare policy relates primarily to people in full-time, people who otherwise would have been in full-time work. So the next picture. So this is a really important picture, and it describes the history of men who were employed full-time in Australia, divided by the population of men 15 to 64, and it starts at 1978. So in 1978, roughly 80% of Australian men between 15 and 64 were at work full time. And then I've divided into these ratios into two groups, WA and Queensland on the one hand, which I won't have a lot of time to talk about, and Australia minus WA in Queensland and Melbourne. And let me just run you through the history here, which I think is extremely important. This is the 81 recession, you see. When you hit the recession, as I said, it heavily focuses on falling male full-time employment. So male full-time employment, instead of being about 80%, falls to about 73%. So you've lost roughly 7% of the population who was previously at work full-time. 7% of the population of men 15 to 64 is roughly about 500,000, just a bit over 500,000. Then this is the strong recovery period of the Hawke kicking years. And you can see that that strong period of recovery delivered lots of gains to people, did not do much for male full-time employment. They created lots of jobs, but you have to create a certain number of jobs because the population's growing, just to stand still. And what this more or less says is that all the job growth in here more or less basically kept still. So from a full-time labour market perspective, for men there was no real recovery. Unemployment fell, but that's for different reasons. It fell not because people went into work, but it fell because people left. Unemployment went somewhere else. I'll talk about that briefly. Here's the 91 recession. You can see how deep that is, right? So basically you lose, you go down to 67 from 73. Again, you lose 7% of everybody between 15 and 64. Somebody's taken out of the full-time labour market. Again, it's a number like 600,000, so I'm now up to over a million. And again, this is the boom years. And so this is the boom years of the Howard period. And you can see that there is no boom from the perspective of full-time employment for men compared to the population. So, but we know the jobs grew a lot, right? The number of jobs grew a lot. But the difficulty was that the number of jobs grew a lot because the population grew a lot. And the population grew mainly because of immigration and so on. So if you look at the very end here, say today, before the recession, you find that at the peak of the boom for all of Australia except WA and Queensland, the number of men employed divided by the population of men is exactly the same as at the height of the 91 recession, which was the depth of the 91 recession, which was the worst recession we ever had. So how did unemployment fall in this period? It fell not because the unemployed went into full-time jobs, because they went somewhere else. And that's what brought the unemployment rate down from 10 to 4. You can see that the only areas where the fraction of men employed, the fraction of the population went up, was in WA and Queensland. Very noticeable, right? But even in WA and Queensland, it never really undid the collapse of the 91 recession. Okay. So Australia's history since 78 has been one of continuous deterioration for men at work full-time, if you just focus on what fraction of them have a full-time job. This perspective, as I said before, there's been a period where wages have gone up, house prices have gone up, you know, pensions have gone up, a whole bunch of things have done better, but not the full-time employment. Now the reason I'm focusing on full-time employment is that this is a major contributor to Social Security numbers. So what's next? So this is doing the same trick again, taking people between 15 and 64. That's the denominator, the population. And then on the top, I'm taking the number of people on income support. Now by income support, I mean people who are relying on social welfare plans for their income. No, I'm not talking about payments for their children. I'm not talking about family payments or anything like that. This is people who get New Start, disability, parent payment single, partner allowances, pension allowances, income, right? So this is you can think this is the substitute in some sense for full-time employment, because full-time employment delivers most people their income to live off on a weekly basis. And you can see, I start this from 65, I start at the bend. In 1965, we had a welfare system, this is sort of interesting in a way, in 1965 we had a welfare system which basically didn't exist. And what I mean by it basically didn't exist is we all had rules and regulations and payments, but nobody used it. Right? That is, the only people, the fraction of people who were using it
amongst men was of the order of 2.5% between 15 and 64. I mean, that's sort of absolute Mickey Mouse numbers. In fact, the welfare system was so little used that half the unemployed never bothered to go down and collect their unemployment benefits. And the reason they didn't bother to go down and collect the unemployment benefits was that they were unemployed for a couple of weeks, right? Or 2 months. Well, they decided to take
the good old days, well, over the good old days.
Yeah, right? And you can see the good old days sort of lasted to 73. Right? Then we had a bunch, two things happened in this period. We had a bunch of reforms which make welfare more generous, extend the coverage, and then that labour market starts to, that labour market deteriorates, as I told you about. And you can see this is the big turn up of welfare recipients, of men up to here. This is before Hawke gets elected. This is mainly a huge growth in disability amongst men. And returned soldiers who are exercising the pension before they turn 65. Here's the recovery, the boom. Here's the recession. Here we are together, and here's the recovery. Now, one of the things I want to talk about, which is interesting, is that there was no recovery on full-time employment, but there has been a reduction in welfare. So at the last period here, which was 2008, we're down to roughly 14% of men between 15 and 64 are receiving their income support direct from the state. So that's roughly 1 in 7. Every 7th male you meet in the street between 16 and 64 is receiving income straight from Centrelink. The major source is disability. The second major one is Newstart. The interesting thing is that the welfare state primarily delivers income to women rather than to men. Women are higher. And you can see that for a general rule, if I tell you the male story, you add on 6 or 7% and then you've got the female story. It behaves exactly the same way. Yes, sir.
Can I just clarify about this diagram that some of those people may actually be receiving employment earnings concurrently with income support?
If they can satisfy the income test, that's correct.
Yeah.
And it's a very small fraction. For men, it's about 10%. And there are reasons for that, which Paul may not talk about in terms of the clawback rates. Okay, next one. I'll finish in a minute. This just goes to tell you that I just made this point quickly because I want to go over my final diagram. These are the peak lines, the number of people on unemployment benefits. We've now got numbers, hundreds of thousands. The black ones are the number on income support. And this shows you that you know, basically the unemployment numbers are a reducing fraction of the total of people on income support. Because what's essentially been happening in the male labour market up until very recently is the reason this thing, notice this comes down much more than that. The reason this comes down much more than that is these people are moving to outside unemployment, they move into disability. So most of the improvement you see in the Newstart numbers for most of this period, up until about 2 years ago, was people taking themselves out of the unemployment pool, Newstart, and moving into the disability payment pool, because that's much more generous and much better all around. So if you can satisfy that criteria, that's the way to go. Next. Now for women, of course, if you're interested in women and welfare, don't waste your time looking at women's unemployment. Women's unemployment is just a large little waste of time. Most women on welfare are not on Newstart, they're on something else. And that's that big gap here. And that something else is either sole parents, or disability, or some payment they're getting through their partner, which is getting harder to get now. So, you know, another pension allowance and so on. Next. Next, maybe I haven't got the one I want. This is where I'm going to stop. This is an extreme. I want to take a pause, take 3 minutes. This is a really important picture. This is the male one. You've seen this before. Right? This is the fraction of men at work, full time, divided by the population. And you saw before the recessions and the flat recovery. This little dotted line, I just pushed the little dotted line out to say, if we do as well as we've done in the boom, which was this, we're going to just basically stay still. Okay.
Then I've added on top of this, the number of men on income support. Right? So I've added on top, so you go back to here, this is the sort of 3%, adding on the 3%, they were on Newstart mainly, right? And then as time goes on, I keep adding on people, right? If you're on Newstart or disability, you get added on. So what this sort of says is that at this point here, 82% of men in Australia between 15 and 64 are either getting their income and being employed full time or getting their income from the income support system. And the gap, this is the income support system. Everybody above the line is getting their income somewhere else. They're not working full time, they're not income support. So who are they? They're retired on a pension, or they're university students, or their partner's working, they're living off their partner, and so on. Now, that message here is the income support, the number of people on income support is growing, right? Because that's the gap between these two lines. But you can see the thing that has been reducing the income support, right? The reason why income support here is bigger and then it gets smaller is this top line. Right? So the main reason why income support has been reducing in Australia is not because the income support people have gone into full-time work, but because they've gone out of income support. Right? They've gone out of income support into a situation where they're supporting themselves, not from full-time work, but from some other way. So if you retired on disability at 64, you're in income support. If you retire at 64 on your own private pension, then you're off. Now, you can see what I wanted to emphasise here is if we can replicate the boom for the next 30 years, that will do nothing for reducing the income support numbers. The thing that's reducing the income support numbers is whatever's happening to this line at the top. Okay. Now, the final point I want to make is if you look at that income line at the top, it looks like a straight line. So it's very hard to say, oh, look, we made all these gains because of welfare to work reforms. Or we didn't make gains back here because we loosened this or we tightened that. Right? It's very much a trend. So one of the basic arguments I want to make here is that on the supply side, on this line that's coming down, the major contributor has not been any initiatives on the welfare side. That is, I want to argue basically the welfare reforms of various sorts have mainly been smoke and mirrors. That is right. They certainly have not pushed people into jobs. Right? You can see that, right? And I argue they haven't pushed people, that many people, out of the welfare system into self-support. And the reason for that, my main is I just can't see the wrinkles in the line lining up with welfare policy. So if going ahead we behave like we've done in the past, you can follow these lines and you can see the welfare budgets remain very large. So as long as people are thinking about the economy in the way we thought about it, either on the employment side or the welfare side in the past, you're not going to see very much. And of course, if the recession goes on and replicates that, then you know, it's going to get a little worse. So the final point is, well, why hasn't the income support reforms of various sorts had any effect? And the main reason is what they do is they reallocate people around the system. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean, if you tighten up on the unemployment benefit system, people tend to flip into disability. If you tighten up on disability, they tend to stay on the unemployment system. You say to wives of disabled people, you can no longer get an allowance through your husband who's disabled, you must support yourself. Go and get a job, that's the new rule, say. So what do? They go down to the social security system and they get themselves a disability pension. So they do support themselves, but they support themselves exactly through the same way. So everywhere in the welfare system, you have these sort of substitutions within the system. And that's my allegation today is that's the major impact of reforms. is to move people around. And I'll finally conclude with just one figure, which I think is a fun figure. Suppose you allow women to retire and access the age pension at 60, whereas men, you allow them to access at 65. And then suppose you say, I don't like this. I know, men and women should be treated equally. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to move the age pension access for women up to 65. If you said, that's good, now the government will save money because they've gone on to the age pension. That's completely wrong. If you say, oh, that's good, now they'll work, that's completely wrong. You know what happens? If you look at the number of women who are accessing a full pension at 60, the number of women accessing welfare payments at 60 now is exactly the same as it was when they could access a full age pension. Why? Well, because they're staying on disability longer, right? And not moving off disability into a pension. They're staying on some other payment. Now, to make this point one last time, what fraction of men do you think go on to a full age pension at 65 and come from a job? Answer, 8%. 92% who go on to an age pension at 65 come off a pension or an allowance. They come off the welfare system. So the major, if this behaviour continues, the major effect from a welfare system perspective of increasing the retirement age is no effect, apart from the label. Right? So instead of being labelled as a pensioner at 65, you'll be labelled as something else.
Thank you. Can you please join me in thanking Professor? I think we'll go straight on to Professor Smith, and we'll Smythe. Have Smythe. One of my staff is spelled that way, and he says Smith.
Yeah,
I had a 50% chance.
Both are correct.
I think we'll go straight on to Professor Smythe, and then save questions till the end. If you can hold your questions for Professor Gregory. Professor Paul Smythe is a professorial fellow in social policy and coordinator of the Masters of Social Policy program co-funded by the Brotherhood of St Lawrence and the University of Melbourne. Paul's chair appointment is to lead research and development policy around partnership solutions to Australia's social problems. His work combines policy development and research at the BSL and with teaching and research at the University Centre for Public Policy. Paul's diverse career combines academic and social action experience. He was previously the Director of Social Policy in the School of Social Work and Social Policy at the University of Queensland. Prior to this, he was a senior researcher at the Jesuit Social Research and Action Centre in King's Cross, Sydney. A former Catholic priest, he has also worked for 20 years in youth and family care. As you can tell, he's eminently qualified to talk to us about the recession and social policy.
Thank you very much, Sandy. So it's good to be here, and I did have a practice run at the Ridges Capital this morning, and I squeezed it into 20 minutes. I hope I can do it so that we can get you out on time. My presentation's entirely different. There's no figures, no graphs, no nothing. I don't understand figures and graphs. My background is more history and theories of welfare and stuff like that. So to try to link to Bob's paper, I loved the bit about the olden days, the good old days when they had the full employment, right? How did that come about? Came about by smart policy work back there in the 1940s and the 1950s after another great big world recession, a real one, the Great Depression. We had a Keynesian revolution, we had full employment policy, government guaranteeing work for all, paid work for all. Full employment was a great period. We all know it broke down. So I think what I was asked to sort of reflect on a bit was with the current GFC, could this be the signal maybe not going back to good old John Maynard Keynes, but it could be a signal of another sort of a paradigm shift, if you like, in the way we do social and economic policy. And so that's what really, it's the bigger picture, like what's in play here at the moment, and could we see some really fundamental change which would make us think about the differently about the way we use the different instruments of social and economic policy. Okay, so we can go to our first one. I can do that. Yeah. So, now, how's this playing out in the public mind? What's the debate that's engaging people? Is there a big shift here or not? The master of the house, Kevin Rudd, stirred them all up back in February, I think it was, when he said, we're in one, a seismic shift. Look out for big policy change. We're going from neoliberalism to social democracy. Remember that? So is this really for real? Is there anything beneath the smoke and the heat of the rhetoric? Well, I'm proposing today that there may well be that the GFC, even though it hasn't turned out to be as big and bad in Australia as what we feared, may actually accelerate some already existing trends which are actually changing the paradigm and especially the way we think about the relationship of social and economic policy. And I guess the key point here, the possibility that I'm opening up for you, is the one that Mr. Rudd gave in his address to the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence a couple of weeks ago at our annual lecture. I think he was answering certain people, certain distinguished economists who were saying, Kevin, stop talking about neoliberalism so negatively. Those pro-market reforms were really good for the country. Don't stop banging on about it. I think what he was saying at the Brotherhood Sandwell oration was that he's not talking about going back to some closed economy, remote from the world markets and all. It's pro-market economy. That's the settings. That's the strategy. But maybe, unlike the neoliberal period, where we thought that maybe at the expense of inequality, social justice, society, we can actually now be thinking about bringing together the strong economic strategy with the fairer society. That was his message, and that's what I'm reflecting on today, and probably in my own way trying to give a bit of a tick and a push to promote this way of thinking. So it's not plucked out of the blue. As I say, this is accelerating already existing trends, and in at least in the welfare world, the key words, punch in the keywords to know how the language is unfolding, the new frameworks are emerging. You'd read about the social investment state and the social inclusion agenda. So we're talking about a new approach to welfare, which is about investment in an inclusive society, an economic arm to it, a welfare arm. Right. So now I know the very mention of social inclusion, eyes roll. Some eyes roll, and people say, oh, what is it, it's driving us mad, and it's probably going nowhere, and all that kind of thing. So, but if having put that one up as one of my key building blocks for the new social policy paradigm, I better justify it. So we've had a slow take-up for the last couple of years since the Rudd people announced it as their motto, social inclusion, and set up boards and so on. We've really been doing a bit of catch-up with the UK, Europe, and the rest of the civilised world. But I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of the substance of the social inclusion agenda had already come to Australia, especially through state governments. Going back to the 1990s, when Jeff Kennett was defeated, when Pauline Hanson was in Queensland, and there was a lot of angst, especially in rural areas, about the effects of globalisation and free market economics on towns and communities. State governments, politicians are very smart, they get the message, and they act quickly. So suddenly we had programs for neighbourhood renewal, community strengthening, whole departments of community set up. And South Australia's came along with a social inclusion board of its own. So we can see all this has happened long before the Rudd government adopted social inclusion as an explicit agenda. So, and it was a kind of a response to some of the ill effects of the, let's call it the neoliberal economic policy model we're operating under. But more important than that, I think the real big breakthroughs came when people started talking about poverty differently. You will all be able to recall a few years ago when there was a big focus on the levels of income support people receiving. Too many people were stuck on welfare. And the whole debate was kind of seemed to be premised that poverty was basically a matter of income, right? And people were getting stuck on pensions, benefit, welfare dependency. It was a negative scene. So around this time, a number of people like Niall Pearson and the Cape York Institute, the Brotherhood of St Lawrence, the Melbourne Institute of Economic and Social Research were looking for new ways to think about disadvantage and the challenge it presents to a society. And the theory that really got traction was Amartya Sen's theories about capability. And this gave us a new way of thinking about what disadvantage and poverty might mean in society. It's not just about the money, right? And so we got this new way of thinking about disadvantage as something that was multi-dimensional. You're a long-term unemployed person, it's not enough to keep them alive on income support. There's probably more about issues of lack of education, or it could be drug, alcohol, homelessness, a joined up problem, a multi-dimensional problem, needing investment to build up the person's capacity and the capability to actually enter into mainstream economic work. So this idea then gave us that we started to shift from the idea of a welfare state to a social investment state, which would be focused on investing in people so they could realise their capabilities, have the opportunity to choose and live the life that they valued. So it wasn't just, but the really dynamic thing, I think, that occurred around 2005 and 2006, it wasn't just organisations like ours that were thinking this way. In the national reform agenda around this time, there was a talk led by Victorian government of the need for a third wave, right, of economic reform. We'd deregulated everything, we'd privatised everything, and they'd given us a bit of a lift. I'm not sure it was as big a lift as Bob says in the 50s and 60s, but they were saying now to get the next lift, the third wave, it was all about investing in human capital. And not just any old human capital, but especially the capital that wasn't working too well, the socially disadvantaged capital. And this was not welfare people, this was Ken Henry talking about SAM capability, investment in human capital. So for the first time in my practical experience working in this sphere, it seemed like welfare wasn't some drag or some money we had to waste on people, but actually social investment, investing in people in their capacity could actually be, the economists could like it, there could be an economic return on investment as well as maybe leading to more fulfilled individuals and communities, social and economic policy coming together. So we're basically playing catch up, and I think the most recent attempt from the UK to say, well, what would this mean for social policy was undertaken by the UK's Equality and Human Rights Commission. And they took the SEN framework, commissioned people from the LSE, and they said, well, look, go and map. What are these capabilities that you're talking about? What is it that people need at the different stages in their life if they're going to participate socially and economically? And so they did the mapping exercise. Just look at the new social policy rhetoric that comes with this new philosophy, if you like, of welfare. It's not about ending welfare dependency, getting people out of welfare. It's about investing in an equal society which protects and promotes equal real freedom and substantive opportunity to live in the ways people value and would choose so that everyone can flourish. An equal society recognises people's different needs, situations and goals, and removes the barriers that limit what people can do and be. Okay, so when I say that we've got these building blocks, are we seeing the emergence of a new paradigm? The building block number one is this, the social inclusion agenda, which the Rudd government has taken on, and just a few reflections there to show how, especially in other countries, we've got a way to go maybe to mature into it, but it is a whole new way of thinking about welfare. Right. Now, I won't delay on this, but this, you know, the Rudd government did take up that rhetoric and appointed their boards and gave them a list of issues to get stuck into, to get some early, hopefully, policy runs on the board. You'd be familiar with that, all of that. And currently, you've got the state governments and the Commonwealth government putting together a joint social inclusion action plan. But it doesn't really tell you much. They give you, here's a list of issues. What we're really looking for is the evidence of some new approach to dealing with it, or are we just rebadging bad old ways? So the only guide we've got at the moment is there's the principles which the Social Inclusion Board has set out. You'll find them on the web page and so on. I just want to comment very briefly to say it's a start, right? It's a start. And it says, what I'd like to have as the first principle, having less disadvantage. Another one, we'll have more participation. But as I say down here, as someone who has been the social inclusion man roaming around academia and bureaucracies talking to people, you get really frustrated when most people, even in the, the ones working in the policy area, still feel confused and wonder, what is social inclusion? Is it really going to go anywhere, blah, blah, blah? And so I think we've got to do more now than just have a really general statement of aspiration, which could mean, you know, anything to anybody. So how are we going to firm up the social inclusion agenda in Australia? And could it look something like what I just set out earlier? So the social inclusion agenda, it's different varieties. It's a new way of thinking about disadvantage, but there's no one solution. Everybody likes the inclusive society, so there'll be the liberal version, or there could be the social democratic version, and in the books you'll find there's others. But I've picked these because Kevin says we're going from this one to that one. What might that mean if it happened? So here, in the liberal take on social inclusion, your integration or your inclusion is really the free market, right? And the social exclusion happens when a number of people, for some reason, aren't integrated into the free market. It may be a very good reason, serious disability or whatever, they can't participate. Or there might be some other people there probably should be in the market but are not, and policies there to encourage them to get back into the market. So the role of social policy is restricted to more like a safety net. We'll have a safety net for the truly deserving at the bottom, but we'll rely more and encourage more spontaneous, like charity effort to sort of pick up the pieces who fall out of the market. Over here, social democratic traditions, much more sceptical, I guess, about the capacity of the market to always achieve these things. You have massive market failures, or you might have great inequalities, thinking people like Marx and Polanyi and Marshall and all of that. So many countries have adopted a more social democratic approach, which where the government becomes the guarantor of the inclusive society, if you like. That every citizen will have a bunch of entitlements, rights and economic and social rights, not whether they can pay for it or not pay for it, as in this model, but just because they're a citizen, right? And so here, instead of a safety net at the bottom, you have like a universal welfare state, and it's quite, this is how I anticipate as we move, as we transit towards some new social economic policy paradigm or arrangement, that we'll have a debate in Australia emerging roughly along those lines, just like in the UK at the moment.
So the Conservatives, they're all for social justice. They've got their own Centre for Social Justice, believe in the inclusive society. But just as in my previous slide, the solution, they want to favour more a safety net at the bottom and empowering families and communities, charities, social entrepreneurs. Let those people go and fix the solutions. Whereas the Labor has tended to focus action not so much on underclass group with problems, but let's focus on the society as a whole to see, well, have we got a society which is actually inclusive? Maybe people are excluded because there are problems with the society, with the market, with gender relations, race, and so on. So here, it's very much public services and income support systems. These become the pillars of an inclusive society. As I say, the strategy for policymakers to flesh this out is to map the resources citizens need across the life course, and this becomes the basis, as it kind of has in Britain, of a new social contract. Okay, we've still got a few more minutes. Well, just let me underline here, especially here, in, I think that people don't realise what a mess Australia's social policy is in, right? Not so long ago, if you were studying social policy and opened up the textbook, we would have been recognised as having a distinctive type of welfare regime, Frank Castle's the wage earner's welfare state, right? Basically relied on these two top things. You'd have a guarantee of full employment for all, that was the Keynesian formula, and if you had a decent wage, regulated originally the harvester judgment, the family wage, people wouldn't need welfare. As Bob said, up into the 60s, it worked. Get people into work with a wage that they can cover their own welfare needs. You'll have a welfare society. That was the original vision. No need for a welfare state. But think of the 1990s, largely deregulated the wage system. There's just a minimum residual sort of effort now for 20% of people at the bottom. It doesn't cover all Australians. Full employment, well and truly gone. It's the problem of the unemployed person, not the government. And the other neat bit of the mess we inherited from the Whitlam years, we tried to create certain universal policies. I think, you know, if we look around, we say, well, haven't we got some kind of a public health insurance system? And we've got superannuation, so we've got elements of universalism, at the same time, very strong sentiment that, we don't like middle-class welfare, as Mr. Buckmaster has written about in Australia, and these people shouldn't be in it. So it's the picture of confusion about what kind of a welfare system we have. It's a mess of leftover bits from previous regimes. More spending than ever, lesson from the Howard years, but no architecture to it. So this is where I'm winding up as fast as I can go. I'm going to propose what this new architecture could look like, right? From the mess to something some rationality and clear principles to it, based on these ideas of social inclusion, an inclusive society, and an investment state. So we pick up the pace and catch up to other countries moving to try to map the risks and opportunities over the life course. Basically, you look at the early years, school to work, working years, retirement and ageing, and that gives you an idea, gives government an idea of, well, these are the things each citizen needs to be able to successfully engage with that transition. I won't go into that, but there's a lot of work to be done around remaking the harvester judgment, bringing industrial wage policies and social policies together around work and family, work and lifelong learning, and so on. So that's the first part, to start to remake the social policy system to offer people a sense they're getting a fair go. That's the sort of structure it might start to have. But I think people like myself are not asking for, let's go back to the Whitlam years, where they had a kind of a social democratic welfare state, but no links to the economic policy change, it all fell in a heap. So Australia, I think especially, we've always looked more to the a strong competitive economy to provide the jobs, preferably the full-time jobs that Bob talked about, paid at decent wages to be the basis of social inclusion. And so that was, I know that people like Paul Kelly and the neoliberals have troubles with the Federation settlement, but that's what it was basically about. Workers were offered the living wage and employers were offered all sorts of assistance so that we wouldn't just stay a sheep farm, that we would develop a manufacturing sector, an urbanised economy, which could actually offer people what we would call today inclusive wages and conditions. 1980s and 90s, people thought, well, that's wrong, it's too regulated and it's got tariffs and it's closed. So for all those good economic reasons, we had a lot of restructuring of the economy towards making us a more free market, open economy. But I think what there's also, we can have any discussion about this, but the lessons I think of the last decade of globalisation have been that those people who have followed a strictly simple deregulation market fundamentalist Washington consensus type model, it didn't work out very well. And the new development economics pushes the idea that maybe that there's a stronger role for government needed in fostering economic development. Welfare states didn't disappear. Read in the paper today, the Scandinavians are the wealthiest and the happiest again. And so there's many arguments why big welfare states, it's good for the economy. You've got high quality workforces and it forces industry to take the high wage path. So finally, why can't we, this is my proposal, remake that Australian way? I've said what it would mean for a fair go, and I think in terms of economic policy, it's just a matter of building on what we've already done with this third wave of economic reform, the social investment and human capital agenda. But it's time, and this is where we could really have a discussion next time with Bob, because this is not my field. But we'll never have an inclusive society if we have a lot of junk jobs and people circulating around in and out of the welfare systems, as Bob describes. You have to have an economy which can deliver more and better jobs, which can be the real basis of people being included. So shouldn't we be revisiting industry policy, maybe, like they did at Federation? We don't want to just be holes in the ground and the export commodity economy. How can we develop areas of our economy which can actually offer good jobs, more and better jobs? And this is the bargain with industry. We've got a bargain with the workers. The bargain with industry is to get behind them. They have to lead the way, the economy down that track. They will get those kinds of support. Produce the employment base that can be the foundation of an inclusive society, and without that, we'll never get there. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for a few. Well, we don't. We've run out of time, but we'll make a little bit of time if people have the time to stay to ask a few questions. Because I'm sure people have some burning questions. I think we've just touched the tip of the iceberg, and I'd certainly like to engage now in a long discussion about both of your presentations. But I know we haven't got time for that, so we will take a few short questions if that's okay with you two, and if it's okay for a little bit more time.
I have a question. Bob, I think that you were suggesting that we need a paradigm change as well. I just wondered if you'd like to comment on Paul's presentation and whether you think that offers the potential for this check for a new approach.
I tend to be
I tend to think of society as being very slow moving and very constrained by all sorts of things. So I don't really, I really see sort of more of the same. I see tighter policies on income support, and I see the main effect of those essentially to move people off income support somewhere else, but not into full-time jobs. I tend to see that increasingly moving people into relying much more on getting money from wherever they can get it rather than full-time work. I mean, the thing that I found disappointing is that many, if you go back to, say, 20, 30 years ago, and look at some of the initiatives we did then, which is sort of similar to what people want to do now, we didn't really get anywhere near the payoffs that we expected. Let me just give you one. I mean, this country's just been through an enormous education revolution. You know, if you look at the average age of children in school, we've basically added 2 years onto it. And 2 years is a lot. If you look at the fraction of people in the universities, we've moved that enormously. You know? And to date, you know, from a welfare perspective, it hasn't really impacted on the number of welfare people. It's still going up. So I think, you know, essentially we have to sort of just be fairly, not have too high, have high expectations for getting things done, but not have high expectations necessarily to be disappointed when you don't get the output you want. And you can see that everywhere. I mean, the initiatives we've done in the Aboriginal area, for example, I think have been really quite spectacular over the years. And again, we've added more years to schooling to Aboriginals. The number of Aboriginals in universities has gone from 2 to, you know, 1,500 or 2,000, 3,000, something like that. And again, very, very slow change. So I think these are very long hauls.
Does just a supplementary, does Paul's model, though, perhaps present us with a different way of conceptualising what we think the problem is or how we assess whether we've been successful or not? I mean, does everything have to be measured in terms of employment outcomes or other measures of success?
No, everything doesn't have to be measured in terms of employment outcomes. I just want to, but, you know, employment is extremely important. Employment delivers money. I think the major thing that's missing from my speech, which was raised by somebody earlier, is that what does the growth of part-time jobs mean for Australia? Because basically in the last 20 years, the majority of jobs have been part-time jobs rather than full-time jobs. And for most people, part-time jobs are a big positive force. There's no doubt about that, because a part-time job allows you to combine it with all sorts of things. But if you look at the group we're looking at, which is the disadvantaged and the income support people, they do not do the part-time jobs. They don't do the full-time or the part-time jobs. You know, you go to any restaurant in Canberra, the people who serve you are part-time. What I always do with foreigners, I always say, you watch this, I say. Somebody comes and I know they got a bit old, and a few years ago I used to say to them, how's the course going? And the waitress would look at me, or the waiter would look at me embarrassed, and he'd say, you're not my professor. So policy impacts on that, right? And one of the things I think is wrong with that policy, which we have to come to grips with, is that any welfare recipient, income recipient who works part-time, the only way you can make that worthwhile is to be dishonest. Because the clawback, I mean, we say to an unemployed person, look, half the job growth in Australia is part-time, but if you take that, I'm going to tax you 75% of the dollar. Why is that? Well, because you're like Packer. Oh, no, hang on, Packer doesn't pay 75%. You're like the Prime Minister. No, the Prime Minister doesn't pay. I mean, what are we doing here? So that's an area that seems to be quite clear, where we're cutting people off from part-time work, not only because it's the money, but also because it leads out into all sorts of other opportunities.
But in other parts of
I'm a very bad chair because I get so caught up in the discussion that I just want to keep listening instead of actually doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So I'm going to have to give somebody another opportunity. Has anybody else got any other questions?
The other one. One more, Bob. Is there any salvation for the declining proportion of male full-time workers in the population that you're talking about, and labour shortages or skill shortages?
I don't think so, myself. And the reason, and if you look at the last boom is really quite interesting in the sense that all that boom went into skilled labour, did not really go into the unskilled labour group. And then, this is something that Paul particularly feels strongly about, where do we get the skilled labour from? At the margin, it came from immigrants. Especially towards the end of the boom. If you look at WA, for example, WA at the margin gets roughly 3/4 of its workers from immigrants, not from the unskilled pool. Queensland gets half its workers from immigrants, and the other half come from New South Wales and Victoria. So the unskilled have done really quite... The education doesn't seem to have reached into them enough, and when we grow quickly, that doesn't seem to reach into them enough. So the latest view, essentially, around the social policy area is to move much earlier on people, to try and get the education system started when kids are 1, 2, 3, and 4. You know, and I think that's going to be a big push. You can see that everywhere, right? You know, the preschool pushing and all that sort of thing. How that will do, I don't know. But it seems to me that's something we have to try. But the problem with that is that when we actually introduce the policies, it's always the people who don't need the policies that capture them. Mm-hmm. You know, you introduce preschools, and who captures them? You know, it's the middle class that capture them. It's not the working, it's not the poor group. The poor group don't capture them partly because, you know, they don't think they need them, you know. And so we've got to do something about that, and I think that's one of our problems, that a lot of our initiatives go to the wrong groups, and the wrong groups capture them, basically. I mean, I think this infrastructure is the same. You look at the infrastructure, you'll find, I think, that the main beneficiaries of the infrastructure are the private and academic schools. Mm. Because they're smart. It's where the smart guys are. They know how to do it. Poor schools don't.
One more question. You had your hand up.
I was just going to ask, Paul, you're talking about really radically thinking about economic, social welfare and educational frameworks coming together.
Yep.
Do you think we've got a framework to have that sort of discussion yet? Is the Social Inclusion Board or COAG going to provide it? Or have we got a long way to go just to get the right area, right space to have a conversation nationally?
No, I think in some ways the dreaded GFC took the wind out of the sails a bit. I think when we had COAG and the National Reform Agenda running, like already they had, the early years was a big ticket item that moved on to the school to work youth transition and addressing problems of kids leaving too early and all that, investing in the, you know, undernourished human capital. So I think that kind of the thinking was there and it was starting to shape policy more generally, but everyone just became so preoccupied with the GFC that I don't think there's been a lot of thinking. I think the big danger at the moment, from my point of view, from being a Brotherhood hat on here, not academic at all, but an advocate, is that what we're proposing is that the whole social inclusion agenda, it should be looking at society as a whole, right? And going through those transitions. This is what we can. It's evidence based. What little kids need, what the school leavers need, right? Retirement and aging, and putting the public service infrastructure. I don't think it's always captured. Look at the public health system. But certainly reaches a lot of disadvantaged people. Public schools. So I think at the moment that we're still at that early stage where they've got a few issues, and it could easily just be a marginal set of policies for a few groups at the side, right? But it won't be a renovation of the social policy system as occurred, say, in the UK.
Unfortunately, I'm going to have to call a halt to questions there. I think this is just, we could be going on for quite a period of time.
Yeah,
talking about the issues that have been raised. You're going to have to ask it after we've finished. I hope that you found this as stimulating as I have. I've found it particularly useful. And I hope you have too. And hopefully people have got your email addresses if they want to email you or talk to you a bit further about some of the issues that have come up. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry that we've finished late, but hopefully you've enjoyed it anyway.
I'm sure.